Thank God I haven't been drinking yet.
We're going to take that
I
away.
I still have a thumb.
We're going to take
okay.
that away right now.
All right, for our television audiences, good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Now, I am Leslie Sobracco, host of San Francisco's KQED television program, Check Please Bay Area. It's all about fabulous dining. Yes, please, thank you. Yes, you can applaud. And I will be the moderator, obviously, for this evening's program. Now, I'm going to just take a moment to introduce who we've got on stage and introduce what we'll be talking about. Obviously, you all know that. But wine is now produced in all 50 of the United States of America, not just here in California. I think North Dakota was the last one, wasn't it?
Yes, in 2005.
Okay. And wine writers Jancis Robinson, round of applause, please. And the fabulous Linda Murphy, round of applause, have collaborated on a beautiful new book called American Wine, The Ultimate Companion to the Wines and Wineries of the United States. Could I please have Ivana White holding that up? Thank you. For our TV audiences. All right. Thank you, Ivana.
I wish.
This... Hey, listen, I know this is off the script, I'm sorry, but I always tease, we travel around and we eat and drink, right? Our whole job is eating and drinking, and somebody once said to me, Leslie, you're traveling all over the world, you work your ass off. I said, honey, in my job, I work my ass on. Are you kidding? A lot of work to get that. So, no Vanna White. Okay. This is a state-by-state guide to the more than 7,000 wineries now in production. Linda and Jancis have joined us today to share their knowledge of wine, colorful tales from the vineyards, and introducing us to the great people they've met and delicious wines that those people are creating. Now, Jancis Robinson has been writing about wine for over 3 decades since she could barely drink. Though she grew up in a small village just south of the Scottish border and was only introduced to wine at Oxford, where she studied math and philosophy. In 1984, she was the first person outside the wine trade to pass the rigorous Master of Wine exams. Jancis Robinson, M.W.
It's a long time ago.
In 2003, she was awarded an OB, Order of the British Empire, by Her Majesty the Queen, on whose cellar she now advises. Very impressive. I want to know if you have an honorary tiara.
Not necessary in my life.
And Linda Murphy lives in the heart of Sonoma County, where she writes for Decanter Magazine and other publications, including the San Francisco Chronicle, where she was the former wine editor and winner of 2 James Beard Awards for her reporting there. Prior to that, Linda was managing editor of WineToday.com, owned by the New York Times Company, where Linda and I worked together for many years. So Linda is a dear and fabulous colleague of mine. Thank you. And in a previous career, and I can attest to this, she was a sports writer at the San Diego Union newspaper, but gave up the beer and shot world for fine wine. Oh, not always. There's still a few shots in her, you know.
No. But that's for later in the evening.
We'll have some scotch and bourbon or something. We'll talk about that later. So, and I've had the pleasure and great honor of meeting and being on a panel with Jancis at Taste Washington a number of years ago and at other events. So I am really humbled and honored to be here moderating this panel with these two fabulous women of wine. So again, another round of applause for Jancis Robinson and Linda Murphy. And now I can officially sit down and get off script. All right. So we're going to talk about American wine. And I have to say that I just came back from a much-needed break. I was on a Caribbean cruise. I was not the one stuck at sea, where I was a wine educator. And I flew home, just got in the wee hours of this morning, actually. I think I still have sand in my shoes, I'm pretty sure. But I read this book on the plane on the 6-hour flight back. And it is fantastic. It is absolutely beautiful. And I don't want to say that I was reading it while I was drinking Australian wine, but it was. I asked for Norton, but they didn't have it in first class.
That's right.
So it is. I hope you all are getting this book. It is really a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And I guess I'm going to start with Jancis and just take a macro look at it. I remember the genesis of this book, by the way. can you just tell us why the time was right to have this first book about American wine?
Absolutely. Well, American wine has always been very important to me. I started writing in 1975, and my very first wine trip as a holiday was to California in 1976. And the very first story I ever sold to a national newspaper was to the London Sunday Times, and it was about the fact that Domaine Chandon existed and that the well-known Moët and Chandon were investing in California, which, they were the first French to do that, and it was a decent enough story, and put me on my way. Since that time, I've been coming back here maybe every other year, sometimes more often. When I was secretary of something called the Zinfandel Club, which was formed in the late 70s to celebrate by Hugh Johnson, Harry Waugh, and John Avery to sort of promote the fact that California was now making really good wine. And one of my jobs was to organize a tasting of all the California wines available in the UK in the bowels of the American Embassy in London. And one of the people who was then importing some actually not very good California wine became my husband, which is very nice.
And he's here, right? Isn't he tonight?
No, he's there. It's an empty
He's not here. When I met him,
he said, I'm planning to open a restaurant which will serve nothing but American wine. And within only 2 months, we were here on the West Coast going up and down to Washington and Oregon. And, of course, lots in California to buy wines for Les Gargots, it was. And it was a big hit in Soho in London in the 80s. Went down really well, except with a table of Frenchmen who came in, ordered their meal, asked for the wine list, took one look, got up, and walked out. But I would say we played quite a part in putting, introducing Brits to fine American wine. And they came at that stage. I don't think we had a Washington at that. No, we had one Washington. So we did have wines from the big three. And then I've been following the fortunes of American wine since then, particularly interested to taste wines from what Linda and I have now come to call the other 47. Because, we all see, you are exposed all the time to fine wines from the three big West Coast states. But I've been becoming more and more aware that the quality of wine being made outside the big three has recently, just recently, been going up at really quite an exciting rate. Meanwhile, I can't believe how every time I recently have come to this country, wine has occupied more and more center stage. It really was quite recent, the mid-90s, when all the wine industry felt under threat. There were big neo-prohibitionist forces. It just was quite a struggle. You had dear old Robert Mondavi sort of beating the drum, trying to convince people that wine was a civilizing influence, just as Thomas Jefferson actually had done before. But it was a struggle. But suddenly now we can, I think, relax, or at least relax for the moment, because it just seems as though everywhere I go, particularly in cities, I have to admit, that lots and lots of young people for whom wine is a really rabid, serious interest, and they're proactive about that interest. They're not, they're joining wine tasting courses, they're going on wine tourism, wine tours, and they're going abroad looking at wine as well. So those two things, and of course there's the recent, very, very recent fact that America has at long last become the biggest market in the world for wine, which is great. It just seemed to me that the time was ripe for a book that celebrated American wine. Concurrently, I knew my dear friend Linda Murphy. We had worked together at The Chronicle.
Yes.
Linda then became the West Coast correspondent for JancisRobinson.com. And I knew very, very well her lovely writing style, which is so lively. But because she is a proper journalist, she knows that she has to get the facts absolutely straight. But like me, she has a very keen eye and ear for what can variously be called human interest or gossip. And so the book is enlivened with lots and lots of sort of good little stories. And so I persuaded Linda that what she really wanted to do was all the heavy lifting in that book.
I traveled with her a little bit. For
not as heavy as wine grapes.
No, that's true. That's true.
Which is Jance's latest book release. That was
before this, yes. It was last November.
Was the book Wine Grapes, that's apparently about this big.
£7.
£7. Mm. And seriously. We're not talking money.
Yeah.
Right.
No, we're not talking sterling. No.
So that's the story from my end. And I think that Linda has, you know, I've written the introduction and, you know, obviously gone through every word and stuff, but Linda is the expert. And Linda's the one, if you want an Indiana winery telephone number, she's the one to ask.
But not tonight, please. Well, thank you for that, Jance. It was a very humbling thing to be asked to do a book with Jance Robinson. I've followed Jance for years. I learned a lot of what I know about wine from the Oxford Companion to Wine, yes. From the World Wine Atlas, which she does with Hugh Johnson, but now Jance is the heavy lifter on that book. So those were my Bibles as I was getting into the wine business. So I left sports writing, moved to Healdsburg, didn't know what I was going to do, didn't have any plan to go in the wine industry, but I decided, well, I need to make some friends here and learn my way around the county. So I got a job as a brick sampler, going to vineyards and pulling off random clusters of grapes and squeezing them up and checking the sugar level, because that's how winemakers know when the grapes are getting ripe. So I met the nicest people and had the most fun and just loved the whole idea of wine and what it does to bring people together at the table and foster friendship and relationships. So I went into public relations for 8 years because my journalism background kind of said that this is where I could find some success. I was never comfortable with it, but after 8 years, I felt comfortable enough and knowledgeable enough to go back to wine journalism, and I call it from hack to flack and back. And I was let back into the journalism world because often when you go...
I want to know what the next one is. From hack to flack.
I hope it stays right where it is. It's difficult sometimes when you go to a public relations capacity as a journalist to be let back in. That was the dark side, and I was let back into the light.
To all our PR friends in the audience, we love you.
They understand. They understand. So because I'm based in Sonoma, and I'm so close to Napa and Santa Cruz and Livermore and the Sierra Foothills, and Anderson Valley is just an hour ride from me, I was learning so much about California wine and Oregon and Washington and traveling there, but I wasn't really getting out of my time zone. And it's not that I was bored, but I was just looking for more things to learn. The best part of what I do is meeting great people and learning things I didn't already know. And if I don't learn something new every day as a wine writer, I'm not particularly happy. So when the opportunity for this book came up, it just sort of opened my world to, yes, here's more adventure. I can taste different wines, expose myself to more wines. And in the process, I found that there are fantastic wines being made in America from unsuspecting states. And we'll get to some of those states in a minute. But the learning curve has been rather mild for wineries in other states because they've seen how California's done it. They've seen how Oregon and Washington and to New York and the East Coast, they've kind of learned from all the mistakes that we've all made in growing our industry. And they've pretty much cut right to the chase and are making fantastic wine.
Although historically, like Ohio... Well, you know, there's other states that have a real history with wine.
Oh, yeah. Wine has been made in what we now call America since the 1500s, when French Huguenots came to Florida and made wine from the native grapes. We now know these to be, I'm not going to use all the technical terms, but muscadine and scuppernong. Perhaps you've heard of those grapes. They're big, fat, sweet grapes that are used for eating, for juices. Now they have great sales for creams and things because they're high in resveratrol, mm-hmm. and antioxidants. So the muscadine has actually kind of redeemed itself a bit. But they didn't...
She didn't mention wine, though, how they taste.
We'll get to that. It's so wonderful.
Yes. When we get
judging,
to Florida. Well, when we get
yes,
to Florida.
Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. So I've been judging wine competitions for years and years and years. And as more non-California, Oregon, Washington wine, the other 47, as they started entering competitions, I started tasting these wines blind. You've got a table of wine in front of you. You don't know who made it. You don't know where it's from. And when the results are revealed, it was just absolutely exciting to see that a Nebraska Brianna, that's a grape that's grown in, can win a major competition. So I was having all these little revelatory moments while judging these wine competitions and saying, I want to know who did that. Who makes that? Michigan can make wine? Well, it makes stunning Riesling and stunning Gewurztraminer and stunning Pinot Blanc. So it kind of re-energized me as a wine writer to go search for
the exotic.
The exotic, yes. And it was very humbling because I realized that I didn't retain as much American history from school as I thought I had. So it was almost, America's history, wine is woven through it from the 1500s with French Huguenots to the 1600s when English settlers came and populated the East Coast, the Atlantic seaboard, and they were not happy with these native grapes that were growing. Norton is one of them. Muscadine is another. They have, not Norton so much, but they have a very foxy, almost musky aroma and sweet. You can smell the sweetness. It's sort of a confected sort of grape, and they weren't happy with those wines because they were not the wines that they were used to drinking in Europe. But if you're from Mississippi or you're from Florida and Muscadine is the wine that you are introduced to, if that is wine to you, then you love it. And so it's sort of where we start tells us what we think about wine. And then we explore and we taste more and we learn more and we actually able to refine our palate to find what we really like to drink.
Okay, you guys were serious, man, about
wow,
questions.
Yeah,
wow.
So.
Okay. First, let me say before I ask a couple of these questions, which will lead nicely into what you just spoke about, please give a round of applause to Ava Bertrand and Gloria Ferrer Winery for giving us
Ava.
A beautiful.
She provided the bubbles
stand
for
up
tonight.
For us, Ava. Santa, Gloria Ferrer, you all need to go there, of course, in Sonoma and Carneros. This is their Royal Cuvée, a terrific sparkling wine. So thank you. I'm going to take a sip of it myself to get through all
it's
this.
So parched.
Oh, my God, I'm so parched. There's a whole lot here, and I'm trying to categorize them, but I think this one's great. This one came in first, and it sort of leads us into, how is it possible to grow good grapes in the Southwest? So, and there's a few others like that that we'll combine, but I think the way that you organize the book by region is really important. And when I sat down to read the book, you read the history, and I'd love you to talk more about that. That first opening chapter is fantastic. It reads like a novel. It's just a really great introduction to the history of American wine. But then you broke it down by categories. And I don't know how you want to address it, if you want to take California and Washington and Oregon first, or if you want to hit the Southwest and talk about some of those others.
I think we should go right to the Southwest, because I imagine a lot of you have a lot of knowledge about California West Coast wine. The Southwest in particular, I suspect you mean Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma. Texas is a very big state. It has some regions that can successfully grow grapes, and it has many that cannot. Those that cannot tend to be in the urban areas, Dallas, Houston, and Austin is on the cusp. But what they've done is they've discovered that western Texas, it's called the High Plains region, is like 3,000 and 4,000 foot altitude, yet it's flat. So you've got altitude, you've got breeze, you've got vines getting this fresh breath of air, and they're growing Cabernet and Tempranillo and Albarino and Merlot and Cabernet Franc very successfully there and bringing those grapes to the urban areas where they're made. Colorado is very much the same. Most of the wines are made from grapes on one side of the Rockies, but the wines are sold on the eastern side of the Rockies, Denver, Colorado Springs, Boulder.
We've got Colorado and Arizona wines, haven't we?
We've got Colorado, an Arizona wine, yeah. A Colorado wine, and tasting if you're staying for the premium.
For those of you in the premium seats, sorry to the rest of you. they've sold out the tasting for the premium wines, and you've got Colorado, you've got Arizona.
Michigan Riesling,
New York,
two lovely Virginia wines,
two fantastic Virginia wines.
Great.
We've got an Oregon Pinot Noir from Southern Oregon, not Willamette Valley, where most of us think all of Oregon's Pinot Noir comes from, but in Southern Oregon, which is an AVA, and there's a new one there called Elkton. We've got a Pinot Noir from there as well. But basically, throughout the world of wine, you try to find the coolest spot in a hot region and the warmest spot in a cold region for planting grapes. So in Texas and Oklahoma, Arizona, New Mexico, wine makers and growers are finding this out. We think of Arizona as being hot desert, but if you get in the northern part of the state, Flagstaff gets snow all winter. There are ski resorts there, the same with New Mexico. So instead of growing where you might live, they're growing grapes where the grapes really can thrive. And so there's not a lot of wineries in these areas, and I'll be frank with you, the quality can be variable. You have to be absolutely committed to doing the right thing for not just looking at how many grapes you grow and how many tons it produces and turning all those tons into wine, but perhaps dropping some crop, lessening your volume, but improving the quality. And a lot of wineries in these areas are bringing in Californians to consult with them, to taste their wines, to give them advice. Very few stay. They tend to come back to California.
And I have to show, there are beautiful graphics, beautiful maps in this book, beautiful sidebars. This one on page 11, I love. I'm very precariously perched here. But this one on page 11, you've broken down by the acreage that's planted. Is it the acreage or is it the...
It's a map of the United States.
Wine production and vineyard acreage as well
vineyard acreage and
a number of
production.
Wineries.
Number of wineries,
because
yes.
We have over 7,000 wineries in the U.S. now. So it's quite fascinating to see this map.
And when you look at this map, I'm not going to hold it up, but...
I am.
Vanna White. the clusters are on the east and west coast because there's a maritime influence. It can be cold on the east coast in New York, in Virginia, Rhode Island, Maryland, but they get some warming influence from the ocean. So the ocean allows them to grow grapes with this refreshing character to them. If you look at the map, the interior of the United States is very sparse in numbers of wineries and grape vineyards. But they are still finding their little spots where it's cool enough to grow hot grapes and vice versa.
And I think that brings up another question. And again, Jancis, I think this is addressed to you, coming out with a book called Wine Grapes. Linda, do you think we'll see more indigenous native grapes emerging in other U.S. wine region states, or will the ever-popular Chardonnay, Cabernet, and Merlot be the predominant grape varieties in those states as well? And as many they can't, because they can't grow. But talk a little bit about the varieties that we see in the book, and maybe Jancis address, in the scope of the world of wine, where does Traminette fall, or where does Norton then...
Well, basically, there are four types of grapes. There's vinifera, which is the classic European grape type, and it's Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, etc. There are fruit wines made in some of the states, like North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Alaska. They can't ripen wine grapes, so they make their wine from strawberries, cherries, berries, apples, even rhubarb, pumpkin. In Alaska, in Hawaii, pineapple wine is really the wine that it makes best. So we included those, but we didn't put a lot of heavy weight to it because I think those are more local palate types of wines, but they're still here. That's why all 50 states make wine, because some are using fruit other than grapes, and some are bringing in California or Washington grapes and using out-of-state grapes to make their wines. We've also got hybrid grapes, which are bred. Some are American and French hybrids blended together, DNA, all of that, to produce a better-tasting wine. And then we've got the native grapes, Norton, the Muscadines, Catawba, Concord, which makes Welch's fruit juice. In fact, New York is one of the largest grape growers in the country, but most of it's Concord, and most of it goes to other purposes other than wine. And if you've ever had Manischewitz, that's Concord wine. And if you've had that, it may not be to your taste, but certainly is to someone's.
And I wasn't going to ask this question. Of the 50 states, what's the worst state for wine? Or is it really? I didn't want to ask that.
We won't go there.
I'm going to put that one away.
But I just wanted to say one more thing about the natives. Norton has become very popular in Virginia and in Missouri and in some of the Midwest states. And Norton has the best chance of making what we might call a serious
It's complex got no, wine. None of the sort of foxiness,
yes,
muskiness.
None of that feral, it's a quite clean, clean
tastes,
wine.
It tastes great.
Yes.
It's a red grape.
It's a red grape. And it's called after a doctor in Virginia, Dr. Norton, who first isolated it, saw it growing and thought, I think I could make some decent wine from that. Mm-hmm. And he was right. It's lovely to see a bit of a revival. But, I'm seeing everywhere, and this is around the world, but it's certainly happening in California too, a much, much wider range of grape varieties being grown now and people being proud of them. It's no longer the sort of Cabernet, Chardonnay, Merlot, Sauvignon Blanc, and Pinot Grigio. it's lovely to see so much, so many different names on wine lists, admittedly on the more trend-setting wine lists. But this is reflected in the other 47, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And Cabernet in particular, you need a very warm climate to ripen.
And a very long growing season.
It's very, very late ripening. So there's no way Cabernet is going to be properly grown well in most of the 50 states. Mm-hmm. But they are looking at alternatives. And I think the market will be quite intrigued by the alternatives nowadays. Not so maybe 10 years ago, yeah, when the market was much more focused. It had to be, you know, one of five grape varieties or something.
And I think that, you know, the millennial generation that you read about all the time is embracing wine and the
curious.
Types of wine. Curious.
Yes, yeah.
This is a perfect time for these unusual to us varieties, varietals, to be put in front of millennials they don't care if it's Brianna or Sauvignon Blanc. If it's good, let's drink it. And so it's a perfect time for the emergence of these, hybrids.
And there are two questions that relate to this. One is exactly that. What new trends are emerging to capture younger drinkers? And there's a lot of talk for those in the wine industry. There's certainly a lot of talk of millennials and their role in the future of wine. This person specifically says ages 21 through 30. Thank you, I fall right in there.
Well, then you can handle the question then.
Sorry. Interest in wine, especially versus beer, cocktails, etc. So you sort of addressed that, but I think there is room to expand and have other exciting grape varieties and other exciting places.
And
you don't have
about,
to always look to Argentina or,
yeah,
you know.
And then the urban winery trend. Mm-hmm. I think that reflects, or, you know, one, I don't know which is chicken and which is egg, but it's all about making wine more familiar. And, you know, you, instead of going to a bar, you go to a winery and see the tanks, see how it's made, maybe even, you know, have a chance to blend your own or something like that. Wine is sort of being brought to us now, which is great, I think.
And Brian Kane is here. Where are you, Brian? Anywhere in here? He has a winery on Treasure Island. Terrific winery. So talking about urban wineries, you know. You can all go visit his winery later on Treasure Island.
It no longer matters whether you've got vineyards of your own or anywhere near where you decide to put your winery or your tasting room. Transportation, chilling fruit, custom crush.
I think that's a very American thing, you know, stemming from Prohibition, when it was the only sort of wine you were allowed to make was sacramental wine and home wine at home.
Yeah.
And so, hey presto, you know, shipments of grapes from California sort of shot up a hundredfold.
And
there is a long tradition of shipping freshly picked grapes.
Can we talk a little bit about Prohibition? Did anybody see Ken Burns' Prohibition on PBS? Fabulous program that was on recently. Mm-hmm. Talk about the role of Prohibition in American wine and where we are today.
Well, this is where I wished I'd learned or remembered more of my history. Mm-hmm. I thought there was a period of time from 1919 to 1933 where you couldn't drink or couldn't buy, you know, a drink, and you made it in your bathtub if you wanted to do bathtub gin. What I never really thought about that deeply, except for the existence of old vines in California, is that Prohibition didn't end Prohibition in the states in 1933. It ended the federal Prohibition. All the states still could have their own Prohibition, so Kansas was the first state to have its own state prohibition in 1881. That's when it cut off sales of alcoholic beverages. And it was the last to repeal its prohibition in 1948. Mm. So for all that period, Kansas could not produce wine or beer or whiskey. And this is true in lots of states. So prohibition didn't just give us a stall period. It slammed the brakes on a lot of these industries. And states were very slow afterward to encourage the return of wine growing. We also had diseases and things, fungus and phylloxera, where some would say, that's too much trouble to replant. I'm just going to plant wheat or whatever. So, and we still are feeling prohibition today.
Well, the three-tier system.
Right, the three-tier system. Do you all know what that is in the sale of, okay, a winery sells to a wholesaler, or also known as a distributor. Distributor sells to the retailer or restaurateur, and that person sells it to you and me as consumers. So there's three tiers removed from the winery and the consumer. So states have allowed distributors, that second man, that middleman, to basically control the movement of alcohol in those states. It's for tax collection, it's revenue, and the fact that the alcohol industry tends to be very supportive of particular political candidates. They have strong lobbyists in D.C.
And so, this is a remnant of prohibition, in terms of distributors.
Yes, because prohibition, when we came out of it, it said, okay, each state can control what happens.
That's right.
And control was certainly a part of it in many states. We're very fortunate in California to pretty much do whatever we want as far as shipping wine in and out of our state and having tastings. Here's one thing that stunned me. It was a while back that I learned this. In New York especially, you cannot purchase wine in a grocery store. You cannot purchase any food item in a liquor store. You can't even get a stick of beef jerky to go with your beer. So to think about food and wine being together and they're made for each other, to not be able to buy both in the same place is really shocking. Tennessee is battling this now. We still have states, Pennsylvania comes to mind, where you cannot buy any alcoholic beverage except at a Pennsylvania state store. They're trying to change that now, and I don't know whether they're going to get away with it, but once again, it protects territories, it protects businesses, and the state decides which wines its residents can buy.
It's been a huge issue in the wine business, certainly for those of you who aren't in the wine business and getting, you know, wine to consumers directly. I'm interested, Jancis, from a global perspective. You know, I've had people trying to get their wines in the U.S. say it's like dealing with 50 different countries to try to get your wine into the U.S.
Yeah.
Where else are they as crazy as us?
I don't think anywhere as ramified. You've got, say, Norway, the Scandinavian countries have monopolies. But most of them serve their customers pretty well, and there isn't this three-tier business and protectionism and making life just very, very difficult. The choice may be a little bit limited, but prices are good because the monopolies just have a set percentage margin, so you can pick up some pretty fine wine at very good prices there.
Canada
certainly has those monopolies. And it generates a huge income for the provincial governments. I was thinking, though, of one good aspect of prohibition, one good, which Linda mentioned en passant, but the fact that it didn't make commercial sense to tend vines during prohibition, however long it extended, means that actually taking a world view, California has some of the oldest vines in the world, because whereas in France there are hardly any really old vines, because there's been a vibrant commercial imperative to keep churning, you know, pull out the old vines that aren't producing very much wine and replace them with something new and more productive. And so that's happened regularly. But in California, you've got lots of really old vines, many of them planted about the same period as the Gold Rush, or just afterwards. People maybe came over for the Gold Rush and then stayed and became vine growers. And there is this lovely thing, the Historic Vineyard Society. I don't know how many of you know about that. But it's been started by a group of growers here in California who are concerned that many of these old vines are under threat. Good examples would be up near you, Linda, in and around
Valley.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
where
Valley.
Lots of lovely old vines, but post sideways, people were much more interested in the money they could get for young Pinot Noir fruit than old-fashioned old Zinfandel fruit. So they're doing their bit. There's a register. Actually, we have a register on my website of all the old vines we can find throughout the world, sort of split by country. But they've really done a great job at logging all the old
vines. So there
vines.
Was a good thing about prohibition.
Exactly. And as we all know, the older the vine, the more interesting the wine. I should make that clear.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And we'll get into that a little bit more, I just have to say for our television and radio audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to co-authors and wine experts, Jancis Robinson and Linda Murphy, about their new book called American Wine, The Ultimate Companion to the Wines and Wineries of the United States. I am Leslie Sobracco, your host and moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and see video of the programs online at For a TV. All right. To get our work out of the way. I want to talk a little bit about the tourism. And is that 30 or 20?
30.
Oh, I have 30 minutes. Usually we go way over. Thank you. So there's a number of questions in here about visiting wine regions. How many of you have visited wine regions, let's say, outside of California, in the States, in the
wow.
U.S.?
Wow.
All right. Just yell out where.
Livermore.
That kind of isn't.
All that way.
Go Livermore. Santa Rosa. Anybody outside of California has, let's say Virginia. Anybody gone
South
to Virginia?
Carolina.
North Carolina. South Carolina. Fabulous.
Georgia.
Texas. Pretty wine country in Texas. Tennessee. That would be called bourbon. No. we'll talk about Tennessee. Anybody else?
Washington.
Georgia. Washington. Okay. Wow. Yep. So a very yep. knowledgeable audience yep. in terms of other places to go. And I think what we see with that is it is often very difficult to get these wines of Texas, of Virginia, of mm-hmm. Tennessee, of, you know, South Carolina outside of that particular region.
Right.
So maybe address, you know, a little bit about when you were visiting wine regions and tasting. And just a note, May 11th is the first National Wine Tourism Day. I just got a note about this. You can go to winetourism.org or hashtag, how many people on Twitter? Okay. Hashtag is Wine Tourism Day on May 11th, and we're all going to be talking about American wine tourism and, of course, your book, obviously. let's talk a little bit about wine tourism and you know, visiting these places.
Well, there are some states led by their governor, in most cases, who sees the financial bonus of having wine-related tourism. For example, Virginia, it's the historic hotbed of our country. A lot of people go see the Civil War reenactments, all the history that's there. But now tasting rooms are located very near these. And so people are coming for the history and maybe trying the wine or going for the wine and checking up on the history. The state has done an amazing job of marketing itself and welcoming the wine industry, of saying, we're going to put very few roadblocks up to you if you do it right, because you're going to help our state, help the state economy, everybody benefits. New York has been very proactive in that, and of course California has, with the Wine Institute working for decades to support the industry and boost tourism. So one of my favorite states that's a bit of a discovery is Michigan. There's a lovely city called Traverse City. It's in northwest part of the state. It's got Lake Michigan surrounding it and these two peninsulas called Old Mission Peninsula and Leelanau Peninsula, and that's where the amazing Rieslings are coming from. Traverse City, in a recent survey, was in the top 10 rising star places to visit in America, largely because of wine. I mean, it's a seaside community, right. But the wine has shot up, and wherever there's good wine, good food will follow. So there's been an explosion of restaurants and delis and local cheesemakers that kind of followed the wine. So these things are happening all over the country.
Right. And talk a little bit about there's been a few questions about some of the other surprises and stars, maybe as you both were reading this book and tasting and, you know, things like Traminette we were talking about. Yeah. Or what are some of those surprises?
Linda obviously has traveled far more widely and tasted far more widely than me, but I suppose I was surprised when I went down. We haven't spoken about Gruet yet, have we?
No, we haven't.
No. So when I went down very far south in New Mexico to find that lovely Gruet family who came over from Champagne. And
it's G-R-U-E-T.
Gruet. And proceeded to plant vineyards and make a very, very fair copy of a French Champagne at a fraction of the price.
That is actually nationally available. You can get that quite a bit.
They make it in quite big quantity, don't they? Mm-hmm. So that was a nice one.
And I can buy it in Santa Rosa or Healdsburg for $15.
Right.
And it's excellent. Method Champenoise, method tradition now.
Yeah.
Bottle fermented.
Yeah.
In New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And I think my first proper trip to the Finger Lakes, I was really impressed by the Rieslings there. And I know you're a fan too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Parche, your newfound love of Michigan.
Yes.
And that's very impressive, I think. And I'm not sure that they realize even there quite how good they are. You know, they probably have, I think that happens a lot. You've got a sort of chip on your shoulder, think, oh, they must all be much worse than in Germany. And certainly the locals think that. And I think, you know, the time has come to be prouder of the local produce, or mm-hmm. the best of the local produce. Mm-hmm. Big fan of Virginia. I was there for the Wine Bloggers Conference a couple of years ago and tasted some really very serious wine indeed. And we've got
two of them
a
are
couple.
Here tonight.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Virginia's
yeah.
doing quite an impressive.
Yeah.
What are they, fifth or sixth or something like
I
that?
I think fifth, Chris.
Fifth in terms fifth, of wine production.
Yeah, yeah. Those numbers kind of. Yeah.
And it's how you measure
right.
it and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
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 But any other surprises that you came across?
Yeah, New Jersey.
Actually, somebody put a question mark in here, a question that says, what grape product gives you the worst hangover? I don't know, it's not going to be New Jersey, right?
It's probably Muscadine. I was fortunate enough last summer to attend at Princeton University what was called the Judgment of Princeton. And so they took many of the same wines that were in the 1976 Judgment of Paris tasting. That,
does everybody know about the Judgment of Paris tasting?
America basically beat the French in both Chardonnay and Cabernet. And it was a shock heard around the world. And it not only gave a lot of American, especially California vintners, some courage to keep going, some validation, but it scared the you-know-what out of the French. They could not believe it.
They thought it was an aberration.
Yes, that could never happen again.
And they said it was just because French wines matured much more slowly than California wines, and that if the same thing was done in 30 years' time, obviously the French would walk all over the Californians. I took part in the rerun in 2006.
Happened again.
California won.
So they tried to recreate this in New Jersey last summer, and they had the first growth Bordeaux against the best Cabernet-based blends of New Jersey, and then they had Burgundy versus Chardonnay. New Jersey didn't win, but it came remarkably close. Wow. It was right in the game. Chardonnay from Unionville Vineyards finished second to one of the Burgundies from Drouin, Clos de Mouche, a very
fabulous wine.
Second. I mean, the Clos de Mouche was heads above all the others, but the other Burgundies, Unionville beat them.
But you know what? You can go to Atlantic City, so they got, you know, they got just over the location.
And the Cabernets did quite well. In fact, I rated two New Jersey Cabernets ahead of Chateau Latour.
Wow. Mm.
And boy, was I embarrassed. But you know what? All the other judges.
So easy to do.
All the other judges, and three of them were for France. These weren't necessarily wine people. They were wine economists whose job it is to study the economy of wine. But they were all very well versed in wine. We all were way off base on a lot of what we thought. Now, keep in mind, there's 50 wineries in New Jersey, and I was told when I was there that really only about 10 are really good and are working hard at it. The other 40 either haven't figured it out yet, haven't got the gumption to do it, or are being taught now. So not every New Jersey wine is going to be good, but I tasted 10 really good ones.
Mm. It's amazing. Amazing. There's a number of questions actually about climate change.
Ooh, nice.
And where we think the U.S. is headed in terms of that. And I know, Jancis, that you've gotten this question before in terms of a global perspective.
Yeah.
So, you know, do you see anything coming from that?
Well, I don't know how the climate is changing in most of the country here, but I do remember very early on when we were talking about likely climate change effects in the world of wine, wondering whether one effect wouldn't be that the north coastal wine regions would actually become cooler while the world was warming up, because the thing that cools the north coast down is the incursion of fog, right? The incursion of the Pacific, which is governed by the heat in the Central Valley. So if the Central Valley was going to get warmer, wouldn't it actually mean that more cool influence was drawn in? And it does, I mean, the last few vintages, it has actually been cooler, hasn't it?
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, if you live here, you probably see that anecdotally, at least I do in Sonoma County, where it's been much cooler in the last few years. I can't say that.
Don't get me started on the Gulf Stream. our winters are getting so much worse because the Gulf. Anyway, that's not American wine, but
I was going to say the UK.
It's snowing.
We could talk about the UK and wine. I mean, people say that climate change and, you know, global warming is going to make, you know, the south of Great Britain the new champagne, you know, the best new.
Yeah. But think about this. What if Arizona and New Mexico and Texas get cooler? Then look at all the more opportunity they have to grow classic wine grapes and in regions that maybe they aren't growing them now.
Right. Although I do feel a bit sorry for Long Island, which is a lovely wine.
Yes, it is Long Island, New York.
Lovely wine. But, God, it's been battered.
We've got one of those tonight, too.
Yeah. Yes.
Make beautiful Merlot and Cab Franc. And, yeah.
Right. The whole East Coast has certainly had more than its share of horrifying.
It's all snowing in New York. Has anybody heard that? It's snowing today in New York. So.
But I was just last week in Australia, and I tell you, that wine industry is bearing the brunt of climate change, of global warming in a big way. Yeah. They're just running out of water. Heat waves are plenty. You're much better off here than they are.
Any Australians agree with that? All right. Here's an interesting one for both of you. What drives you both to write?
I like to eat. I write for food.
You have a T-shirt, we'll drink for food, right?
Yeah.
Deadlines, really.
It's fear.
Fear. Yeah.
Well, this is sort of becoming a cliche, but I think it was Dorothy Parker who said, I hate writing, but I love having written.
Yeah.
And that's sort of how I feel about it. I swear and I struggle and I work. I do have to work at my writing. It doesn't come all that easily to me.
Well, it reads as though it does.
Yes, it does.
But it's a lot of work for me to have it read that way. And so the longer I'm away from having it done, the better it kind of looks. I think mine is from this passion to tell stories, especially from the wine industry. There weren't too many really wonderful stories in sports writing, let's face it. That's, you know, you see the underbelly of that, and it kind of spoiled, you know, athletics for me from an appreciation standpoint because it was a business. And so it's wine, but it's a lovely business. And when I find somebody who's doing something different, who's really pushing envelopes or doing wonderful things with charity, whatever it might be, I want to tell those stories, and writing is the way to do it.
And I think that really comes through in this book is you pull out individuals that have been important pioneers in the wine business and give them their due, and you get to read really interesting stories about people. I don't know if you want to talk about some of them. I mean, I just, you know, people that are coming to mind is, you know, Randall Graham, I think, is actually in this book. And Randall Graham is sitting right there. I just fabulous. Bonnie Doon over there. Well, pioneers in the industry.
I think we were asked, or maybe it was, I don't know if Jensen was there this last week, that do other states have, or maybe Mary asked this today, do other states have their own version of a Robert Mondavi, a crusader and a proselytizer who constantly talked about California wine, not just Napa wine, but all of California wine, and kind of pulled the cart. It was the horse that pulled the cart for everyone in California. There are some in other states that have been that. Most of them are no longer with us. But if you talk about pioneers, you look at Dr. Constantine Frank in the Finger Lakes, who was the first one to prove the naysayers that you can grow vinifera grapes in the Finger Lakes, which is a very cold region, warmed by these fingers of lakes, so that there's some maritime warming. But people said it couldn't be done, and he did it. But he did it with Riesling and Gewürztraminer and German varieties that are good for that climate. Walter Heyman used to work for Seagram. He founded a winery whose wine is here tonight, Llano Estacado, in Lubbock, Texas. Well, Lubbock is cattle country. It's wheat and grain country. It's not Austin. It's not Dallas. It's not Houston. But he saw this high altitude, that 3,000-foot elevation I was talking about in western Texas, started a winery there in 1975. the first Texas winery in modern times. And it's going strong today. So Walter, and he came from this sales and marketing and global view because he worked in the wine industry here, that he kind of pulled everybody along with business smarts, know-how, how to distribute wine, you know, how to sell it, how to price it. So he's pretty much been a father in Texas.
Well, and I think, and I'd love chances for you to talk a little bit about this, because we've had a number of questions about history in the U.S. And, you know, unlike other areas, let's say Spain, for example, or in Rioja and Priorat, where you have, you know, ancient winemaking traditions, and then you've got a renaissance that's happening because of younger members of families that are running the wineries now. They've gone off and traveled the world and worked in Australia and then California and then come back and revitalize the region. In terms of the U.S., we don't have that, I don't want to say baggage, we don't have that tradition. How has that affected what we've been doing?
Well, you don't have tradition, but...
I mean, we have tradition, but right, but not to that extent.
A lot of leaders have a heck of a lot of money, which helps, actually. Yeah. And I would say that there are some admirable techniques. I'm not talking about fiddling in the winery and manipulating winemaking techniques. I'm talking about getting to grips with your vineyard and understanding it. And I would say I've seen more advanced, detailed knowledge, money thrown at how to analyze what each parcel of the vineyard has to offer in Napa Valley than I've seen in even First Growths in Bordeaux. They were there first. So I think you do have the advantage of great American determination, a lot of money in many cases, and sometimes a lot of wineries are sort of almost vanity projects. So people who've made a lot of money already and this is how they're spending it.
They need a hobby.
They need a hobby. It's a large hole in the ground into which money is thrown.
Well, there's that saying, you know, how do you make a small fortune in the wine business? You start with a large one.
That's right. But I take my hat off to them. And I think, and I love the fact that the general trend now is, I know it's a cliche, but much more attention is being paid to the vineyard than fiddling around in the winery. Mm-hmm. And another compliment I would like to pay is the caves. Is it only in Napa Valley there are caves, or are there Sonoma caves
Sonoma caves. Yeah. But I mean, more money in Napa, thus more caves.
Okay. But even if they cost a lot to make, once they're drilled, they're wonderfully ecological. They're not using up masses of energy. You know, it's cool in there. It's naturally cool in there. Much more, in my book, much more admirable than these huge warehouses they're building around Bordeaux at the moment, which, you know, cost an absolute fortune to air condition, are using up the world's resources far too fast.
Well, there's a couple of different questions that people have submitted, and it has to do with green. You know, are we going greener in the U.S.? Are we responsible for helping to drive that trend? Do you think we're doing that?
Well, I think the wine industry, there have been some very proactive wineries and vintners and grape growers who realized it was the right thing to do, and Fetzer comes quickly to mind with its focus on organics. But now it's almost like you stick out like a sore thumb if you're not doing something to reduce your impact on the earth, to leave the ground in healthy conditions so that your children and their children can farm it. There's all kinds of programs in a lot of these states. Oregon's got a strong one, Washington, California, sustainable agriculture programs that point out the benefits. If you use cover crops like legumes and fescues and vetch and things like that to control erosion, to add nitrogen to your soil, and grapevines love the nitrogen, rather than letting the mustard grow wild and disking it every year. Because the mustard's really a weed. And these cover crops are healthy and beneficial, and they harbor beneficial insects that eat the bad ones, so you don't use as much pesticide. Spraying has gone down dramatically in the California wine industry because we've got more neighbors around us now. We're not all out in the country anymore. We've got people living near us and animals that we're living amongst. And I think there's been a real solid drive to be sustainable and to do the right thing. And some people have had to be shamed into it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Did that answer the question?
I think so. I think so.
And with water shortages, you know, water reuse is a big, big thing,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, we know all about that.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, is something that, will be not even an issue. You know, you're going to have to be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hopefully we won't be applauding everybody who is doing things now, because everybody will have to do it.
If I get another press release from a winery saying, we're sustainable, I'm going, oh, God. You dang because, well better
right,
be.
It's like, our website is now live.
Two interesting questions.
We redesigned our label.
Two interesting questions. Will Americans ever develop a European palate? Now, I find that interesting because we're not European. There's a couple of other questions that relates to, which is, what's happening to high alcohol wines now that Parker's retired? Where is, you know, wine criticism going? I read this as more of a trend question, which there have been quite a few of that. What are the trends, and is there a trend toward lower alcohol, which to me is what European palate is, a more refined, you know, an appreciation of refinement? Or should we say, forget that, screw that, we're Americans and this is our palate? And I don't know how you can say Americans as a category, but.
Well, I think, especially in California, where we can control the conditions pretty well, in some places, colder regions, that it is what it is and there's very little you can do. There is such a wide range of terroir, of soils, of exposures, of climate, that we in California can grow any style of wine we want. You just have to pick the right place to grow the grapes. We had a little bit of a discussion about this earlier today, about a Napa style of wine, a Napa style of Cabernet Sauvignon. And I think there's multiple styles. It depends on where you are. Calistoga is much warmer than Carneros or Coombsville at the south. Elevation, mountain vineyards tend to not get as ripe because they run out of growing season. It gets too cold, the vines shut down, it starts to rain. So you're harvesting grapes at lower sugar, thus you're going to have low alcohol when it's converted. The critics have, certain critics have certainly driven a high alcohol style by giving them fantastically high scores, which automatically sells the wine. That's not so much a consumer issue to me. That is the distributor, the retailer, using the score to help sell wine quickly. But with this bit of climate change that we've been seeing lately, and I think there are some wineries that are intentionally making lower alcohol wines by picking the grapes earlier.
I would say, from a sort of global point of view, I'm seeing all around the world. I'm in the process of updating the World Atlas of Wine at the moment for the next 7th edition. And the one common thread, there's always a new common thread with each edition, and the one common thread of this one is that everywhere in the world is looking to produce fresher, lighter styles, as well as a wider range of grape varieties. But I love the fact that there are now other voices and other factions, and what is it, Raj Parr and somebody have their in pursuit of balance, isn't it? So there are other voices and people pressing for other styles. But I would say that the only country not even Argentina, and definitely not Chile. I think the only country in the world where there is a sizable proportion of wine drinkers who still are rabidly for high alcohol, big, powerful wines is only here. I'm not saying that's wrong. It's just an interesting phenomenon that it exists only here. I can't think of any other country in the world that has not...
Australia?
No. They're skinny. Australian wines now. No, they've suddenly, you know, they've gone into reverse. Oh, it's all their Shirazes are being renamed Syrah, and you know, so that you can see the bottom of the glass. And as for Chardonnays, they've all been put on a serious diet, and some of them are sort of austere. And where's the fruit? No, they are. Forget it. No. And the Argentines and Chileans are very explicit about their desire to be making slightly more refined, refreshing wine.
But I think it's fantastic that we do have these wide range of styles so that anybody can find a wine that they like if they do like the taste of wine. Mm. And let's face it, it keeps all of us a job. if they all tasted the same, we wouldn't be here.
But I think there was a time when they tasted much more similar than they do today.
Yes.
There was more uniformity in wine style.
Well, and I think by writing a book like this and having everybody talk about it and read it, you bring such attention to all these other styles and all these other states so that we do know about Ohio Riesling or, you know, Michigan Riesling or fantastic Sangiovese from you know, Texas Hill Country so that you can have an appreciation for that.
I have one little anecdote on that. I was in Texas last year, and Texans want to grow Cabernet, big Cabernet for the beef. I mean, it's a source of pride. Well, there's a very wealthy man outside of Austin who has lots and lots of Cabernet in the ground. And they told him, you're not going to be able to get it ripe in all years. Well, I'm sorry, I take this back. Well, yes, so I was there this last year, and he's now planting Baco Noir, which is a French-American hybrid, because he's lost his shirt on Cabernet. His bravado finally, you know, the hubris finally has gone away, and he's looking at his financials, and he's planting Baco Noir where Cabernet once grew.
And who knows, that could be their next signature variety, right? Baco Noir.
Could be. Baco Noir, always.
Well, what Linda was talking about in her book, you know, there's a slogan, it's time for muscadine, or what was the...
Make mine muscadine.
Make mine muscadine.
I was thinking about doing T-shirts for this, but I didn't know anyone who would buy them.
Well, we only have just a few minutes left, so I'm just going to ask you, if you could pick one of those wines from your book, I usually dislike these questions. What's your favorite wine? And my answer always is the one in my glass, because I get to drink it. But if there was something interesting that you'd like to pick up right now, would it be a Michigan Riesling? Would it be an Indiana, I don't know. You can't pick California. I'm not letting you pick California. Where else would you?
Well, what I would love to do is have a couple Michigan Rieslings and a couple from the Finger Lakes and taste them side by side and try to determine the differences. I don't get to do that very often. There's a feeling that Michigan wines, Rieslings are a little bit sweeter, but I've had some marvelous bone drying ones too. So that would be a comparison I'd like to make. And there's some wonderful reds from Virginia.
Yes, I am really looking forward to tasting that Michigan Riesling because I think it's about three vintages later than the last time I tasted it. But I think the one wine that popped into my head, I think we actually have it, is a new Virginia Bordeaux blend. And you might say, does the world need another red Bordeaux blend? And the answer is probably no. But he is trying so hard and doing such a great job in just the first couple of vintages, and he has the wonderful name of Rutger de Vink. And
Belgian, I think?
No, originally I think Flemish perhaps, or Dutch. And it's RDV Vineyards is the name of the outfit, and there's one over there.
It's a pricey wine, it's $75 retail, and a lot of Virginians said he was crazy, that he was going to kill it for the rest of them. But the wine is head and shoulders above most being made in Virginia, and he's putting his money where his mouth is.
I think it might be his father's money.
Oh,
he's putting his money. But he does live...
Better money to spend than your own.
Exactly, and he does live in a... Is it a Winnebago? You know, a silver thing.
Oh, Airstream.
All right. It is time for us to close. We could go on, obviously, for hours and answer all the rest of these questions that I didn't get to.
How many? Everybody must have put in two questions.
This is great. I can't even get
them all. Leslie made them up.
So we have to end for our audience. We want to thank our wine experts, of course, Jancis Robinson and Linda Murphy. Big round of applause for these guys. We know that everybody is going to go out and buy this book, so they're going to be signing books right here after we're done. For those of you who bought premium tickets, kudos to you because you get to go drink $75 Bordeaux blend. The premium guests, the wine tasting is right over here, and unfortunately it is sold out, so sorry for those of you who want to come. And we want to thank everybody who's watching on the internet and watching on television and listening on radio. I am Leslie Sobracco, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.